Ready to rise above loud, angry headlines? Longing for an alternative to the world's fighting and fear-mongering? Christianity Today magazine offers a trustworthy, faithful perspective on stories that matter to you, from the church next door to movements and ministries all around the world. Subscribe to CT for full access to in-depth reporting, insightful commentary, and redemptive storytelling, both online and in print. A subscription to CT also includes seasonal devotionals, special issues, and exclusive content. Visit orderct.com today or click the link in the show notes to get started and join a growing community of thoughtful, evangelical Christians who value different news that makes a difference. That's orderct.com to subscribe today. We spend a lot of time on podcasts like this predicting the future in various ways. But as we do that, we know life is really unpredictable. And as the scripture says, we do not know the number of our days. And that's why it's a really important thing to have a will, to protect yourself and your family. Christianity Today has partnered with Epic Will to walk you through the entire process of creating a will in as little as 10 minutes. You don't have to have a law degree to be able to walk through this, and that's why it's really helpful. So visit morect.com, that's morct.com, will, that's morect.com/will to get started today. Hello, this is Russell Moore, and you're listening to Signposts, and today I am really excited about the guest that we have with us because he's one of my favorite historians in the entire world. I read everything that he writes, and it's fascinating because it's so wide-ranging in terms of sometimes I'll pick up a book or an article on an issue I didn't even know I was interested in, and by the time I'm 10% of the way through, I'm passionate about that issue or that historical figure. And that's Dr. Thomas S. Kidd, who is he's a history prof at Baylor University, the James Vardaman Endowed Professor of History there, and he's the Associate Director of Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion. He's written a lot, and you will have seen his work in the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, and he has several books that are coming out over the next year or so. And I want to talk about some of those issues today. One of those is about America's religious history, faith, politics, and the shaping of a nation. And the other is Who is an Evangelical? The history of a movement in crisis. And so these, of course, are very relevant topics to our time right now. Tommy Kidd, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, in my understanding that you also have an American history textbook that's just dealing with the breadth of American history. Is that right?
That's right. That has come out as we're talking, and it's with B&H Academic, and it's really pitched to the freshman-level Christian college market is sort of the bullseye of what we were going for there. And a lot of Christian colleges, as you know, are sort of struggle with what textbooks to use, especially outside of Bible and religion classes. There just aren't a lot of great options. Mm-hmm. And so we thought that I could produce something that would come from a Christian perspective, but would also bring a kind of professional historical perspective to the topic, and hopefully will meet a need in a lot of Christian colleges.
Well, of course, we hear often about the sorts of ideological struggles that come with the teaching of history. And so yes. You can have, on the one hand, something like Howard Zinn's People's History that really gives the impression that the American project is an evil project for the most part. And then you can have other history works that seem to just whitewash everything that isn't triumphant in mm-hmm. American history. So how do you sort through all of that kind of conflict?
Well, it's a real challenge. I think as you get narrower focus on things like the American founding, The temptation often for Christians is to say, well, don't you know, all the founding fathers were believers, and it's sort of this uncomplicated picture of Christianity's role in the founding, and then it's all kind of gone downhill from there. And so I'm trying to show throughout the story of American history how profoundly important religion is, Protestantism, evangelicalism, but that's not always an unvarnished good, and that there's problems. I think we know well now that with Christians and slavery, Christians and the civil rights movement, and so forth. So I'm trying to foreground the role of faith, and of course, many, many ways that faith plays a heroic role in American history. And yet that it's also problematic at times, disappointing at times. And I think I found in writing the textbook that, especially once you get to the 1960s, is when my perspective on what has happened over the past half century really starts to diverge from the dominant secular textbooks, because they tend to say, well, first you have the civil rights movement, and then you have the women's rights movement, and then you have the gay rights movement, and then you have the legalization of abortion, and this is, it's all part of their sort of seamless fabric of progressive development and individual rights, individual expression. And I felt like that was where I tended to take kind of a minor chord of sort of approach on those kind of issues, and say, of course I'm fundamentally sympathetic to the civil rights movement, but these others often came with serious downsides.
Mm. When you look at, for instance, the issue of slavery, what can we learn about the way that religion was used in terms of propping up slavery and then later Jim Crow, and the way religion was used to oppose those things?
Well, it really is a dilemma, I think, in terms of the theological role for Christians in the debate over slavery in particular. There's a long-standing, millennia-old anti-slavery position among Christians. Mm-hmm. But because slavery was so entrenched in the American South by the early 1800s, there was every cultural and social and economic pressure for white Southern Christians to be pro-slavery. And when they looked at the Bible, they did not see a clear statement of "thou shalt not own slaves." I always tell my students, I wish there was that kind of 11th commandment that would just show that these people were in outright disobedience of the scripture. But as we know, I mean, the scripture is kind of surprisingly ambivalent. It's dealing with slavery in the ancient world, not chattel slavery of the kind that existed in the American South. And so, Paul says, "Slaves, obey your masters," and so forth. And so, if you were pro-slavery and a Christian, or at least a professing Christian in the antebellum South, there was really no compelling biblical argument to get you to see that it was immoral. I think it was immoral from beginning to end because of the chattel nature of people being bought and sold and stolen away from their homes in Africa and so forth. But the letter of Scripture was not as clear as we might hope that it should be. And so I think that you have these entrenched sides, some really militant anti-slavery Christians, some really militant pro-slavery Christians, and they just simply couldn't solve the issue. And so it requires the work of General Grant and General Sherman and so forth to get to the institution of slavery destroyed. And so Lincoln, who is kind of skeptical about Christianity, but increasingly I think is coming back towards his own parents' faith, during the Civil War, he's the one who has to say, both sides read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and pointing out the kind of irony and tensions of Christianity's role over slavery. And as you suggest, I mean, there's similar dynamics going on in the civil rights movement of, we're so often just bound by our culture, and our culture dictates to us what we believe about these kind of salient political issues of our time. It's humbling, I think.
You mentioned that you think that Lincoln was sort of coming back to his parents' religion. I mean, sometimes people, if they think of Lincoln, they just think of him as a revered figure, and so maybe some Christians just assume, well, he was a great man, so he must have been a great Christian. But most people who have some historical awareness realize this is not a church member, maybe right. one of the most religiously disaffiliated political leaders that we have had at that level. What makes you think that he was maybe on a journey back?
Well, he grew up in a devout Baptist, Calvinist Baptist family on the frontier, and it seems like that by the time he was a teenager, he was already being exposed to skeptical writings, things like Tom Paine's The Age of Reason and this sort of thing, and seems to have gone through a skeptical phase as a young man. But I think that there's a comparison to be made to Ben Franklin. In the sense that's kind of Franklin's story, too, grows up in a devout Puritan family, exposed to skeptical writings as a teenager, goes through a skeptical phase. But I think for Franklin and for Lincoln, as they grow older and the weight of political responsibility weighs heavy on their shoulders, I think both of them go through a kind of gravitating back towards thinking that faith is important, that providence is working somehow in American history. I think when you see the nation going through war and revolution in Franklin's case, and all the demands that puts on you as a leader, it's kind of tough to be adamant about your skepticism and your religion in times like that. And so and Lincoln, of course, has terrible family tragedies. Struggles apparently with depression himself, and I think all those kind of personal and political factors lead him back towards an appreciation, at least for sort of the biblical tradition, and that's why it comes out so strongly in the Gettysburg Address and his second inaugural address, and Lincoln becomes, I think, the greatest articulator of the biblical tradition in American politics, ironically. Given his skepticism, he's able to employ religious rhetoric to the greatest effect, I think, of any American president.
You know, that's one of the things that you do really well, is to point out both how important biblical revelation has been, if only to react against sometimes, or to be informed by from a distance in American life, but also to point out that that the mythologies that we can build, either of all of the founding fathers as being atheist, secularists who didn't want biblical revelation anywhere near the public square, or the mythology of the founders as born again Christians to a man or to a woman, in the case of Betsy Ross and some others, that both of those are not the case. That the situation is a lot more complicated than that. Why do you think that we as modern Americans are drawn to that sense of the founding fathers as being really mascots for whatever we are, whatever we believe right now?
Yeah, that's right. I think both the left and the right, secularists and Christians, are tempted to use history for primarily present political purposes, and that's always a bad approach to start with, partly because history so often introduces us to people who are just very different from us. And famous saying, you know, the past is like a foreign country. They do things differently there. Mm-hmm. So you go to the past and you should expect to find people who are just very different from anyone you know today. And I think Franklin and Jefferson are two great examples of this. People who are skeptical. Some of the other major founders, Patrick Henry is one who I think is really a traditional believer. But Franklin and Jefferson really are deists or kind of Unitarians, if you want to put it that way. But they're so conversant with the Bible. Franklin knows the King James Bible backward and forward. It's because he grew up in a Puritan family, and they didn't have much else to do. Right? Yeah, I mean, they're just, I mean, they're, they, and so he, I'm an evangelical myself, you know, and I mean, I read the Bible every day, but sometimes I thought, I think Franklin knows the Bible better than I do. And Jefferson's the same way. He doesn't have the text mastered the same way that Franklin does. But, Jefferson routinely throughout his whole life is reading the New Testament in Greek. He reads the Septuagint. I mean, his level of biblical scholarship surpasses, I suspect, many pastors today. Mm. And that's Jefferson. I mean, you think, how could this be? Well, it's because to them, I mean, it's what they grew up with. For Jefferson, this is what it means to be a learned gentleman in the South. And it's what it means to be an intellectual in his time is to be deeply conversant with the Bible. And that's just different from our culture today.
You mentioned Jefferson. Let's take Jefferson as a test case here, because I find that when I'm reading the founders, Jefferson and Madison sing for me. I mean, the language that's being used, the vision that's being given is so profound and in many places so profoundly beautiful that they seem heroic. And then on the other hand, you turn around and you look not just at the skepticism and the religious and theological and ideological ideas that Jefferson had, but his personal conduct in some ways. Now, I know there's a lot of historical dispute over what happened exactly with Sally Hemings, but we do know that there's at least a good case to be made that Thomas Jefferson was sexually exploiting people who had no power. Under his watch, and even before that this person who wrote for us that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights was owning human beings in an evil and an unjust system. How then do we go into the 4th of July in that case with that sort of ambivalence? Or then later, when we look at other people that we tend to think of as heroes, but then we see some dark and sometimes very ugly things going on in the background.
Yeah, it's a real challenge. And of course, I think you could look at some people, George Washington, who I think, even though, you know, he's a slave owner, I think, there's a lot of things to admire about his personal integrity and leadership. So I think it runs, you know, a range. You mm-hmm. certainly have that among people like, you know, Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, a great revivalist of the Great Awakening, both slave owners. And I think in our cultural moment, we are struggling to know what to do with this more than ever before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I recommend to people to just remember that we're all locked up in our time and place and culture. And that if the Lord tarries, you know, 200 years from now, we can be sure that people will be looking back on us and saying, what were they thinking? Yeah. You know, I mean, what's the matter with these people? And I think like to style ourselves as the people, we're the morally enlightened ones. We're the ones who are the epitome of cultural progress. I mean, people across the political spectrum tend to think that about ourselves. And I mean, I tell my students, you know, look, just remember, if you're born into a white slave-owning family at the time of the American Revolution, it's almost certain you would have died as a slave owner and supporting slavery, thinking slavery was a positive good. Mm-hmm. And so, before we wag our fingers at these people, we need to remind ourselves that we're not that different from them. Now, I mean, I do think that you have people like George Whitefield, who I've written a book on, as you said. I mean, he was more of an activist for slavery than, say, Jonathan Edwards was. Yeah. So he's more problematic, I think. You know, Jefferson, his relationship with Sally Hemings, which most professional historians think is, you know, about as demonstrated as you can demonstrate anything mm-hmm. like that, especially after the DNA testing. With people like that, I mean, there's especially egregious things that they did that sort of stand out in their time.
Yeah.
That I think are subject to greater criticism. But in general, I think we just have to be humble about realizing that if you were there in their time, we shouldn't assume that we would have done any better than they did.
And that requires a deep Augustinian view of sin, where sin is taking place not only in terms of the flesh, but the world and the devil. And so often there can be an entire atmosphere around one that can render one's own sins to be almost invisible. That's a sobering and scary thought for me, anyway. Now, you've got this book coming out called Who is an Evangelical? And I've read this book ahead of time and love it. One of the reasons I think this is going to be a helpful book is because I find when I go to college campuses, you're on a university campus all the time, I go around to them all the time, and I find in campus ministries, this is often about the number two question that's asked if we have an open Q&A session, which is, we don't want to be called evangelical, and so what should we do? And my response to that is to say, you know, I'm as kind of frustrated as you are about that, but I don't know an alternative to it. I think we just have to define what we mean when we say evangelical as opposed to something else. Why are we in this situation where that word is so contested?
In a way, it's a lot longer story in evangelical history because, as I suggested with Whitfield and Edwards, I mean, these are some of the founding fathers of the evangelical movement in the 1730s and 40s, and yet they're connected to things like slavery and slave owning that are problematic in ethical and moral ways in their time, and they're connected even to political imperial concerns that seem very, very temporal and maybe short-sighted. And you can say that about, you know, virtually any evangelical leader as you go on through time, especially ones who had access to politically powerful people. Mm-hmm. For sure, you can say that about Billy Graham. I mean, you know, when you think about Graham's succession of relationships with presidents, who would turn that down?
Yeah.
But it also led him into especially a really problematic relationship with Richard Nixon.
As he acknowledged.
As he acknowledged, and Graham ended up being kind of one of Nixon's last defenders, and mm-hmm. then finally realized what a sham Nixon had been, and so, but I think in a way the key turning point is probably 1976. Sometimes we think of the moral majority as the key turning point. It is important, but 1976 is the first year in at least in the modern era when the term evangelical itself starts being used commonly mm-hmm. in the media, and it's never used to discuss evangelical revival.
Yeah.
Or evangelical church services, or evangelicals praying with their families, it's always used to discuss evangelicals' political behavior.
Yeah,
and I mean we can't blame the media for that. They don't care about religion
right.
as religion usually, unless mm-hmm. it's involved with scandal. But they do care about religion's role vis-a-vis politics.
Yeah.
And so Jimmy Carter is nominated, 76. Newsweek calls it the year of the evangelical. In 76, and maybe most importantly, that's the first year when Gallup begins to ask people in polling whether they're an evangelical or whether they're born again.
Mm-hmm.
And if they say that was, yes.
That was very frustrating to my predecessor in this job at the time, Foy Valentine, who said,
yeah.
evangelical is a Yankee word. We're not evangelical.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that. And so they start asking people if they're evangelicals. And if they say yes, then they go on to ask them about their political behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't ask them, how often do you go to church?
Yeah.
Or what do you believe about the Trinity or anything like that? They ask how they vote.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the moment to me at which evangelicals, core practicing evangelicals, start to lose control of the public image of their movement. And there's a way in which it's almost nobody's fault, but I think it bears terrible consequences for evangelicals today who are constantly having to try to explain what they mean by evangelical.
Yeah. Yeah, which to some degree is always going to be the case when you're dealing with shorthand. And as you mentioned, not just in 1976, I don't know a lot of people right now who define themselves when they're just talking to themselves as evangelicals.
No, I mean, I go to as evangelical a church as you can find. It's in Waco, Texas. It's mm-hmm. a big Baptist church, and it's as evangelical as all get out.
Yeah.
And there's almost nobody there besides me who would ever use the word evangelical.
Yeah, in my church as well. And I think that's typical. I'm always dealing with younger evangelicals. I have this conversation about every single day where you have younger evangelicals. Oh, no. The evangelical movement is collapsing. It's falling apart. It's all of this scandal or all of this hackery or all of this whatever. And I always have to turn around and say, hey, guys, that's the case. Those same conversations are being had in every single generation, just about, that we have going all the way back to Carl Henry's Uneasy Conscience and before that, and the response to the Uneasy Conscience. When you look at, you're with young non-Christians and with young evangelical Christians and other folks all the time. Are you hopeful or are you nervous about the future of evangelical Christianity in America?
I think I'm mostly hopeful, actually. I mean, when you frame it that way, because I see so many young people at Baylor in particular who are what they're committed to is to Jesus and the church and kind of whatever you call it, this movement. Sure, they know that there are problems and they know about the grifters and the hucksters, mm-hmm. but that doesn't define their faith.
Yeah.
And so what I see is, kids who are interested in training to be missionaries and training to be pastors and church planners, and their faith is, I mean, you can see in a really sort of healthy and unproblematic way, their faith is just not challenged by the politicization of the national image of evangelicals. And a lot of these kids probably tend to be fairly apolitical themselves.
Yeah.
They just see their primary commitment is to the Lord and to the church. I'm regular around hundreds of kids who are just like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, you know, I agree. I mean, what are we going to do? How do we get, the national media to change the word that they use for evangelical? I mean, it's sort of fruitless.
Right.
But whatever we call this movement, especially from global perspective, we're doing fine. The Lord's in control. And so I guess at the end of the day, I have to be hopeful and optimistic about it.
Yeah, I agree with you. One of the things I've noticed going around to university campuses all the time is that the students who are evangelical Christian students who are there in their campus ministries or who come to events or whatever, none of them are participating in their campus ministries or in their church life, or very few of them, because Aunt Sally's going to be asking, where were you Sunday morning, or were you at your campus ministry event on Thursday night, and are you doing personal evangelism? They're not there out of some sense of cultural pressure. They're there because they really know the Lord and want to serve the Lord. And on the other hand, what I notice is, and I think I'd noticed this, but I hadn't put it into words until night before last, when I was talking to a friend of mine from the United Kingdom who said that secularization has gone to such a point in the UK that he's not encountering, doing apologetics of various places, he's not encountering the sort of angry new atheist, Christopher Hitchens sort of stuff that you would have had from 10 years ago. He's encountering atheist people who have never really been around real Christians and so have a sense of sort of curiosity about it. And I said, you know, that is exactly what I'm experiencing when I go around to college campuses. I interact with a lot of atheists and agnostics and secularists, but most of them don't see Christianity as the big bully omnipresent around them that they have to react against. They see it as something kind of weird and strange, and they're curious about it, which is a great opportunity to then talk about, this is why Christians believe what they believe, and here's what the gospel is.
Yeah, I've actually found that in the academic publishing world, because most of my publishing has been with secular academic presses, and virtually all the people I work with there are not believers, And I don't pick up, you know, a bit of hostility towards me. I think they may find me sort of peculiar,
right?
What I think is a totally appropriate reaction to Christians. Yeah. But and you know where this flares up is when your faith then gets connected to cultural issues, views of sexuality and marriage and right. so forth. And then there really is trouble. Yeah. But if your faith is being encountered as faith in the living God and salvation through Christ, I think we're past sort of hostility to that. For them, it's like going to the zoo. I mean, it's like, wow, look at this interesting creature. Yeah. You actually believe things about God. Tell me about that.
Yeah.
And I think that represents an opportunity for the church, especially given the wreckage of, you know, the sexual revolution and all the changes we've gone through in our culture over the past half century. I think we're interesting ways that we're entering an era of new opportunity for the church.
Yeah. And where there's trouble, we've had trouble before. We survived the Roman Empire.
Yeah, so, that's right.
Tommy Kidd, thank you so much for being with me today. These two coming books that are coming out this year, Who is an Evangelical and America's Religious History, when will they be available for folks, Tommy?
So Who's an Evangelical will be out in September with Yale University Press, and then America's Religious History will be out in November with Zondervan.
All right, you'll want to check those out. Tommy Kidd, thanks for being with me. Always great to talk to you.
Great to talk with you.
This is Russell Moore, and you've been listening to Signposts.